Now the occasion of us being here, of course, is 200 years of Christian witness on this spot in Hanley. Although, of course, when the chapel was built, this wasn't in Hanley, it was in Shelton. And next door, imagine 200 years ago, we would have been standing, you'd be seated, I'd be standing in a large old chapel. Many of the folk here, of course, will remember it. Large old chapel in which there's a gallery on three sides, high pulpit. There would have been big box pews, which people won't remember because they were taken out over 100 years ago. And there would have been no organ. It would have just been led by a man who would have a little pitch pipe to set the pitch of the singing, and then they would have sung without accompaniment. And next door would have been, we've sort of seen in 1812, the remains of a grand 17th century manor house called Shelton New Hall, which had been turned into a pottery works. And the bottle kilns would have been rising behind it, the smoke going up into the sky. And why was it that a new chapel was built here in 1811, opened 1812? Well, before that, there was one congregational church in this part of the Potteries. It was just up what's now Town Road in Hanley, where the car park is for the Potteries Centre. It was called the Tabernacle. And it was a grand church, very active, very missionary church. They sent people out to found new churches, people out to preach the gospel. And one of the deacons there, sadly, it's recorded that he was unduly given to strong liquor, and on one occasion had outraged public decency by falling off his horse, the worse for drink, in the streets of Hanley. He was, of course, picked up, taken home, and the church leadership had words with him afterwards. They said to him, "Where's the effect of what you're doing, and you cannot be a deacon if you do this sort of thing." He had some very close friends who spoke to him and then came to the leadership and said, "Our friend has repented, and he should be allowed back into the church." And in fact, they kicked up such a stink about it that while the church let him back in, they then said to his friends, "Now you're going to have to answer to a panel of inquiry why you've kicked up such a stink." And his friends said, "We don't recognise the panel of inquiry, we're off." So sadly, we must say this church began in rather unfortunate circumstances. It happened that the New Hall Pottery was selling off what was called the Hall Meadow next to the hall, 1811, and the new church bought this site and they built this, the original chapel here. The preacher at the opening service was William Robey of Manchester, who was one of the founders of the London Missionary Society. He was the most famous minister in all of Manchester at the time. Robey had started out as a Methodist and got into Congregationalism. And it says quite a lot that he was willing to speak at the opening of the church here and took such an interest in it, as he recognised that this was an important site in the centre of the Potteries. For the first few years, there was no minister here. They were visiting pastors, visiting preachers, and young men would come from the theological colleges looking to be called as a pastor. In 1814, a new street was laid out there, and that's Hope Street. So this was called Hope Chapel originally, and when they built the new street, they called it the chapel. So that street is named for this church, and not the other way around. And in 1814, a man who had come to the church several times to minister came. We've got his picture here. This is the Reverend John Greaves. And he was pastor of the Congregational Church at Buxton in Derbyshire. That building doesn't exist anymore, but the congregation is now the Buxton URC. He'd been a Methodist, The Methodists had refused to accept him for training for their ministry, so he went to the Congregationalists and they accepted him. And in 1812 he came to Buxton, 1814 he came here, and 1815 he decided actually he preferred being a Methodist, and he went back to the Methodists again. We hope that the church did not drive him away. He was apparently very popular here, and people were most upset when their pastor announced one morning, "I'm going to join the Methodists." And the Methodists then sent him to Buxton, probably hoping that some of the people from the church at Buxton would think, "Oh, pastors in the Methodist church will come to the Methodists instead." Grieved having gone off the Methodists, he became a very well-liked Methodist minister, and his sons were Methodist ministers, and he had a grandson who was a Methodist minister, and so on. And one of his great-grandsons was the minister of Westminster Central Hall after William Sangster died. But he went off, Greaves went off in 1815, and so they need another pastor, and they went for another man who'd been a Methodist. We seem to have a history here, really, with the Methodists. And the man they chose was a man from Nottingham called the Reverend William Farmer, but he was ministering in Leeds at the time. He had been born in 1780, and his father was a reprobate, a wicked man who was supposed to be a druggist, a chemist. He left the running of the shop to his wife while he cavorted with a succession of loose women, got drunk, and of course the result of all this cavorting and drunkenness was that he died a very early death. And his wife, Mrs. Farmer, remarried a respectable Methodist minister, and so young William was brought up among the Methodists. When the Methodists, after the death of John Wesley, split, young William Farmer stayed with the majority of the Methodists in Leeds, who joined the Methodist New Connection. And we know a lot about them here because they built Bethesda in Hanley. That was one of the great centres of the New Connection. The New Connection sent William to Leeds, and there in Leeds he met up with a man called Edward Parsons, who convinced him to become a Congregationalist. In 1806, William Farmer was ordained as the pastor of the Congregational Church in George Street in Leeds, which is a little but very wealthy church. And he was very well supported by Edward Parsons, who was one of these great leaders of the Congregational churches in Leeds at the time. He even edited an edition of the works of William Bates, one of the Puritans, so he was a great lover of Puritan theology. In 1815 he got this call to Hanley, and he decided he'd come here. He arrived at the same time as another Congregational minister. The Tabernacle had also called a new pastor. The Tabernacle pastor was 10 years younger and had just come out of seminary. But William Farmer had been in the ministry for many years, over a decade, as though he had so much more experience. And these two ministers became very close friends. In fact, there are times when, looking at the history, it seems to me they did everything together. They spoke together at anniversary services, they spoke together at the opening service of the Baptist Chapel in Hanley. They were joint secretaries of the Staffordshire Congregational Association, did everything together. And this church has probably never been more important than it was when William Farmer was the minister. It was packed with fairly wealthy people, potters, grocers, shopkeepers, probably the odd innkeeper. In those days, being an innkeeper was a quite respectable trade. All sorts of people. And in 1821, 1, on July 18th, there was a great service when three missionaries were ordained. First missionaries ever to leave this church were ordained to go out onto the mission field in India. They were sent out to Calcutta. The ordination was in the old building here, but there were so many people wanted to hear the final sending off service, they had to rent Bethesda Chapel, biggest chapel in the Potteries, packed to capacity to have these three young men go off to India. And their names need to be recorded. They were J.B. Warden, James Hill, and Micaiah Hill. And James and Micaiah were not related. Farmer led the service, and the ordination sermon was preached by William Robey from the text, "Here I am, send me." And here were these men and their families. Some of their families had been dead set against them going to India, but praise God, the families came round to see that it would be a great work to go out to India to preach and to teach. And they went out to Calcutta and were sent out. After a year learning the language, there was no school in England that would teach the Indian languages then. They were sent out to the various mission stations. Among them, Micaiah Hill was sent out to a mission station, a place called Tallygunj. And he records what one of the missionaries, or one of the Indian converts, said when they opened the new station. An Indian Christian was asked to speak and given total freedom as to what to say. And this is some of what he said, translating to English. "When we are afflicted, we sometimes go into the wilderness among snakes, jackals and tigers to procure the juice of a tree by which we obtain a cure. Thus that which we dislike to procure becomes salutary, saving. It is so with religion. We do not like this house, the mission station, yet it is for the worship of God and the only true Saviour. We do not like the Bible, yet it is the only true word which brings salvation from sin. We do not like the Sahibs, the white men, yet, like the Jews from the wilderness, they come from a far country to heal the diseases of our hearts and to turn us from idols and the devil to the true God. Thus you see, good people, those whom we think friends are enemies, and those whom we consider enemies are our best friends." Well, they were certainly honest. He was certainly honest about what the Indians felt about the missionaries. It says a lot for the missionaries that they were willing to print that statement by a native Christian. But he was quite clear also that the people they did not like were those who were bringing the word of salvation. Now, these days missionaries go out and you can come back a few hours by plane. Back then it took the best part of a year to go by sailing ship from England to Calcutta. And for most of the missionaries, it was a one-way trip. There would be no return to England. They would live and they would die in India. J.B. Warden was the first one to die. And it's recorded of him. He died on 8th of January 1826. His illness lasted 6 weeks and was extremely painful. James Hill wrote of him, "His sufferings were extremely great to an extent I have never witnessed in any other person." Speaking to Hill, Warden said, "With regard to my own safety, I have not had a doubt. And with reference to death, it seems to have lost all of its terrors. I know I am a poor, worthless creature, but the precious blood of Jesus, how it perfectly answers all my wants." His fellow missionaries gathered around him, distressed at his pain and suffering, seeing how he suffered, they were extremely distressed. James Hill says, "Sometimes when, on account of his debility and great suffering, I have been reluctant to propose to pray with him, he has requested it with so much earnestness, and afterwards appeared at a loss how to express his gratitude. He asked them to sing with him just the day before he died, 'What's him? There is a land of pure delight.' It's a hymn about heaven." And at first it was just those seated around him who were well who sang, but when it came to the lines, "Infinite day excludes the night, and pleasures vanish pain," with all the strength he had, Hill says, he joined with us and continued singing to the end of the hymn, and the ecstasy depicted in his countenance and expressed in his tones was indescribable. And on his last day he said, "Oh, to see Jesus, and to see him as he is, what a glorious sight. And my poor father will then meet his wayward firstborn, of whom he had the least hope." So you get the impression there he was a rebellious youth. His father died before he was converted. And now he was rejoicing that his father was going to see him in heaven. His last words were, "Oh, to be lost in wonder, love, and praise." He left behind him a wife and a son, and his wife said, rather than going back to England to her relatives, she would stay in India to teach the Indian women, and she stayed until her death. James Hill was invalided back to England, and Micaiah Hill was left alone until he too died in 1849 in India, aged 58. His eldest son came out from England to take his father's place. Isn't that a wonderful beginning to the missionary work coming out from this church? William Farmer remained here until 1824. Sadly, 1822, he was taken ill and had to travel to stay with his brother-in-law in Clapham. And when he came back, there was an accusation made from Clapham that he had committed adultery. He always strenuously denied it, but although initially the church accepted what he said, there were those who did not, and the church sadly split. And he and 50 members went and started a new church down Brunswick Street. The building is Portofino Restaurant today. And that building was Brunswick Chapel. It became Trinity Presbyterian Church eventually, which was finally Trinity URC. People may remember it, where the Royal Bank of Scotland is today on Trinity Street. So again, they had to find a new pastor. And the man they chose was a man from Sheffield called Samuel Jackson, who had been orphaned very young, brought up by his uncle. And he too decided that he would sow his wild oats. And so rather than working in his uncle's business that his uncle wanted, he got an apprenticeship the other side of Rotherham to be as far away as he could from his uncle. But of course God works in mysterious ways, and it was while he was there in the far country, as it were, that a man came to preach in that village called James Bennett, who was minister of the Independent Chapel in Rotherham. Bennett came preaching the gospel, and Jackson was converted, and soon he became a minister himself. He went to train at the college where Bennett was principal in Rotherham. His obituary has a rather interesting remark in it, saying, "He is one of the few of whom it can be said that his piety sustained no injury by passing through a collegiate course." I think the man who wrote that had a very low opinion of theological colleges, but evidently felt that his friend Jackson was not affected by the college. He was a minister in Germany. He took a summer pastorate in Germany in 1824. And in 1827 he left us to go to Barnard Castle. He was followed by a man who had met the missionaries in India. A man called John Edmonds, who had gone out as a missionary, came from Dorset, went out to preach in and to teach in India, but he had been invalided home due to tropical diseases. He was going around on deputation work. In those days, deputation work was generally done by ministers who were forced to, by missionaries who were forced to leave the mission field due to ill health. It wasn't missionaries who would come home for a furlough. It was missionaries who would come home to recover their health and then hopefully be able to go out again. And Edmonds had come preaching, and they'd been so impressed by this deputation worker that they'd invited me to pastor. And so 1827 he became the minister, stayed here till 1841. And the missions of the London Missionary Society were primarily educational. They would go into an area and they'd start a school, because while high caste Indians would object to a church being built, they all understood that education could be very useful even for them. If you learned English and bookkeeping, you'd get a good job in the civil service. And so by doing that, the missionaries could get a foothold in an area and people would be able to hear the gospel because of the teaching. And Edmonds, even when he came back from India, was very big on education. And he had a big building built at the back of this chapel. You can see some pictures of it at the back. The big building that was built on that waste ground, now the overflow car park, for Sunday school. And it could hold some 300 pupils with all the teachers taught in various classes. At one point it was used as an actual day school, before the board schools were built a little further down. With the emphasis on education again, young people would hear the gospel. Sunday schools, of course, were originally schools that met on Sunday. And they were for teaching those children who were working in the factories, who had no other day off. And children who learned reading and writing and arithmetic in Sunday school could get better jobs later in life. So it was first of all educational, but of course it was always a Christian education. The Victorians and people of the 19th century did not believe in values neutral education, but that education always teaches values. Edmonds was replaced by a man from a very good evangelical family, Reverend Charles Fox Vardy, who was the son of a minister, a grandson of Matthew Wilkes, who was one of the most famous ministers in London in his day. Vardy had been trained at Highbury College in London, which was actually the same college that John Greaves went to, but he's moved. One student at Highbury said that he learned two things at Highbury. He learned patience and how to shave with cold water. Hopefully other students profited more from the course. Vardy also, he was the first minister here to graduate from a university. The universities in England were closed to non-Anglicans. But in Scotland, they accepted students from all sorts of religious backgrounds, and so Vardy went and studied in Glasgow. William Farm had studied in Edinburgh, but he never graduated. So Vardy was our first graduate minister. And he had been pastor at Hounslow, but had to leave Hounslow because he fell in love with and married a girl in the congregation. And it was a rule then that ministers were not allowed to marry their own church members. Ministers had to marry someone outside the church or resign. And so he resigned and married the girl, and they both came here to Hanley, where he was honoured and beloved for his work's sake. He carried on working in education. Even after he was forced to retire from the pastorate because of ill health, he worked with educational organisations. Well, sadly, he had a breakdown. He left us in 1844. He was followed by Robert Macbeth, who was indeed a Scotsman from Aldwick in Caithness. His father was a, get the impression, a typical Scotsman. He insisted that his sons spend some time working on the family farm and learn a trade before they did anything else. And so Macbeth was a farmer and a cabinet maker, and then he was allowed to go and train for the ministry. In 1841 he entered Blackburn Academy Theological College, which was about the worst time to join Blackburn Academy because the school was just about to move to Manchester. And rather than actually keeping on the teaching in Blackburn, they just let everything slide in Blackburn until they could set up in Manchester. All the faculty were going to leave when Blackburn closed. The theological professor was rapidly going completely blind and could not read his lectures anymore. And Macbeth said if it was not for the other students and for their self-motivation, it certainly taught them that, self-motivation, they would have got very little done. 1843 he started in Manchester, and 1844 he came here. He was a member of the British Anti-State Church Association, who spoke on their platform in Hanley. So in this, the old chapel here, they had meetings advocating the disestablishment of the Church of England, in which he said that most of the Methodists in the Potteries were in favour of it, whatever the Methodist conference might say. He was noted for the way he opened worship, always saying, "Let us worship God." In 1849 he married a daughter of a member of the church at Congleton, in the old chapel there. 1851 he was called away to Darlington, and then he got a letter from a church in Hammersmith called Broadway that was about to close. And they decided that just before we close we will call one more pastor. So Macbeth came to Hammersmith to minister to a tiny handful of people in an old echoey chapel. Within 10 years that chapel was packed to the rafters. It was so full that they had to build a new chapel. He remained there for 40 years. Greatly used of God. Hammersmith was the place where God had called him to be. Well, with his departure, the church here had to find a new minister, and they approached a man who was very close to retirement, a man called Mr. Deakin. He came from Shrewsbury, he trained with Jackson at Rotherham many years before. You remember Jackson was here 1825-7, and now 1851, a man who would be in the same college at the same time as called. He'd had 3 previous pastorates, and he came here just for 4 years, and then he retired. Now, Mr. Deakin, James Deakin, was a lover of books. He had a library in his home that was floor to ceiling Puritans, old nonconformist divines. Huge library. He departed, he left us, retired, and went over to Bolton to live. He was followed by a man who came from Warrington. He's called from Wycliffe Church in Warrington, called John Kay. John Kay was the man who introduced the weekly collection. There was no weekly collection here until about 1856. Not that we didn't have any collection, but you had to pay for your seat before then. If you wanted to be sure of a seat in church, you paid for a pew, and they'd have doors on them with locks, and you'd have a little card with your name on, or you'd have a number, and that number pew was the family pew. But in 1856, John Kay said, "We're getting rid of pew rents, and we'll have a weekly collection instead." Writing it a couple of years later, he said, "I'm glad to find, after 2 years' experience of it, that they like it. I've not met with a single exception." But before that, unless you want to sit on one of the free benches, which weren't very comfortable, you had to pay. But he got rid of that. 1860, then he went off to Thirsk. He was followed by one of the most interesting and exciting men to have been a pastor here, Richard Henry Smith, who was the son, his dad had been a pastor in Oxfordshire. He trained at Highbury College, and he graduated without a pastorate, so he left the college and didn't know where he was going. He moved down to the Isle of Wight and started helping out with a little church in the village of Brading. And they called him to be the pastor, 1845. And in the course of his ministry there, they built a new chapel. The local Anglican vicar was very hostile to nonconformists and said, "You cannot send your children to our school unless they go to our church." And so Smith said, "All right, we'll build our own school then. So we won't send our children to your school at all." And then the vicar said, "I won't bury your children, because they haven't been baptized in my eyes anyway." And so they had to buy a new burial ground so that they could bury their own children. This could be, these refusal to burial, to bury cases could be very nasty. There was one that dragged on for several months, and you can imagine the child lying unburied all those months. Eventually got the vicar in deep trouble for not burying. He came from the Isle of Wight to Halesworth in Suffolk, a little market town which he found so sleepy and so depressing that he immediately left to plant a brand new church in Surbiton in Greater London. And he began the church. They couldn't find a room to meet in, so he built a chapel in his back garden. And in 1860 he left Surbiton, got that church started, and he came to Hanley. He loved a challenge, did Richard Henry Smith. That's why he didn't like Halesworth. It wasn't a challenge. He loved a challenge. He found the chapel surrounded by poverty. These were the days in which Arnold Bennett was born above a pawn shop in Hope Street. And all these little shops, you look above them now, these windows, and all of those windows would have had a family living up there. Sometimes the shopkeepers, quite often they weren't the shopkeepers, but they were having the room let to them. You'd have whole families in single rooms in some places. And of course the potteries made everything black or grey with smoke and dull. And Smith put his mind, how can we make the lives of these people more blessed? First of all, of course, we bring them the gospel. And how shall we bring the gospel to the poor? How shall we reach the working people of Hanley? That was the great burden upon his soul. His preaching was remarkable for its spiritual power. He had formed the high ideal of the Christian life and condemned departures from that ideal with a pungency of expression which sometimes gave to his ministry an air of sternness and severity. He had a dread of mere religious conventionalities and mechanical contrivances to secure religious ends, and insisted on the necessity of living by principle, not by expedience. And you hear that, you think he must have been, you know, sort of man who repelled people, but quite the opposite. As a consequence, he attracted many who were repelled by ordinary religious methods and powerfully influenced for good minds which had been untouched by other agencies. He was an artist and a lover of art, and he wrote several books on fine art. books of exposition in which he brought out fine art, things like Leonardo da Vinci and such like, and he taught by means of these pictures. So he would take a copy of The Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci and he would explain the imagery here and use it to proclaim the death of the Lord Jesus. He would take an image by another fine artist of the Transfiguration of Christ and show how that picture spoke of our redemption by a divine Saviour, by one who is God over all, forever blessed. He wrote several books, and we have one of them at the back there, which you're welcome to have a look at. It's from my library, Expositions of Great Pictures, written, published in 1863. He believed that good, wholesome, pure religious art, in place of the sort of pictures of prize fighters and the like that people had in their little flats, the good, pure, clean religious art would be a blessing. And he had a men's meeting on Sunday afternoons where he would fill the chapel with working men. And every week he would have a picture he had drawn himself, painted himself, of one of the parables of Christ. And he'd explain the parable with the picture. He used art as a means of preaching, as well as the pulpit. He believed in the education of the poor and bringing these values of the true, the real and the beautiful to address the mind rather than the eye. He said, good art does not just appeal to the eye, it appeals to the mind, it makes you think. He illustrated several children's books and even wrote a few children's hymns. And it was a great loss when in 1864 he accepted a call to plant a church in Hampstead in Gospel Oak Fields. He was followed by David Horne. I'm sure many of you have heard of the comedian Kenneth Horne. It's the same family. David Horne's brother was the grandfather of Kenneth Horne, the comedian. And David Horne himself was the uncle of Charles Sylvester Horne, one of whose hymns we sang a couple of weeks ago, Sing We the King Who Is Coming to Reign. David Horne came from Yorkshire, from Keighley, but was of Scots parents and had been trained at Airedale College near Bradford. He had three pastorates before Hope and had been in Salford when the church here called him. He was a very thoughtful man, relatively shy man, a man who was most at home among his books and with his close friends. Nevertheless, a series of lectures he gave on Darwinism packed the old chapel with people who wanted to hear what the church had to say about Darwin. Sadly, we don't know what he said, because all the report says is that the lectures were given and the building was packed. Charles Sylvester Horne was brought up in Newport in Shropshire, so quite often would have visited his uncle here in Hanley, and quite probably as a young man preached in the old building. David Horne's ministry here was very blessed, and yet it was tinged with tragedy. In 1868 he lost his first wife and soon afterwards both of his children by his first marriage. In 1870 he married again and again had two children, a son and a daughter. In 1881 he was one of the men affected by what the newspapers called the Hanley tragedy. what happened began with an actor called Mr. Siddons travelling back from an engagement, the theatre, in February. As he came to partway along Bucknell New Road, he saw something on the pavement which proved to be the body of a man in the attire of a clergyman, a nonconformist minister. And this man, his hat and his umbrella were nearby, but there was another hat and umbrella nearby as well. And they belonged to David Horne. Of course, Mr. Siddons, the actor, called the police. The police went round to Mr. Horne's home in Birch Terrace, and he opened the door with a very nasty head wound and not able to remember how he had got home. The rumour mill, of course, went into overdrive at this point. You can imagine, dead clergyman, injured clergyman, evidence that the two were together at the time of death. The first rumour that went out was that they'd been ambushed by a man who had killed one of them and nearly killed David Horne. The other man was discovered to be Thomas Cocker, who was the minister of the chapel in Stoke. But then people heard that David Horne had been told by the police not to leave Hanley, and so of course the rumours went he had killed Mr. Cocker. Turned out that in fact it was negligence that had killed Mr. Cocker and nearly killed Mr. Horne. What had happened was the work between Bucknell Old Road and New Road had been going on. They'd built various streets, and one of them, about where the footbridge is today, was called West Street, and it had never been finished. And the contractors at the end, instead of putting up a barrier, had just left it, so that 20 feet up in the air, West Street suddenly stopped, and then there's a 20-foot drop. The first 10 feet were a very, very steep incline, the last 10 feet sheer drop. And it had been a foggy night. The two men had been talking about Bible translations, which is a very absorbing topic. Anyone who knows the internet will tell you that there have been some wonderful arguments about Bible translations. You get all kinds of books. The two were talking about Bible translations on the way home, missed their way in the fog, and before they knew where they were, they had both gone over the end of West Street. David Horne was a strong, burly man from his Scots background, and Thomas Cocker was not. Thomas Cocker died on impact. David Horne suffered a severe concussion and staggered home, not knowing what had happened. Papers, of course, were outraged when they discovered what had happened and condemned the council for allowing a road in this city, in Hanley, to be, as the Sentinel put it, a fatal trap and a pitfall. Horne's finally ended up retiring in 1885, just after the Congregational Union of England and Wales had had their autumn meetings in Hanley, and where this chapel played host to J.P. Gladstone, who some of you may know as the man who wrote a book on George Whitefield, had spoken here on home in its relation to social purity. Gave a message on how we are, how important a Christian home is. David Horne retired. 1887, he took the oversight of the church at Alsager. Their minister had gone off to America and they were looking for a pastor, and Horne said he'd fill in while they were looking. And then he retired to Bowdoin in Cheshire. In 1885, he was followed by William Lansdowne, who would born in 1859 in the city of Norwich and brought up in Prince's Street Congregational Church under the ministry of George Slater Barrett, who was known as the Nonconformist Bishop of East Anglia, a man who wrote many books, who compiled the denominational hymn book, wrote an excellent book. Bernard L. Manning, whose father was minister in Copeland Street for a few years, said he thought that Barrett's hymn book, the Congregational Church hymn book, was effectively the best hymn book ever written. Would not myself go that far, but it was an excellent book. Following Horne, Lansdale was called straight from college to the ministry here, and he moved in to a new home in Rectory Road in Shelton, a few doors down from Shelton Rectory. And if you were to go there today, you would notice the rectory was this great country house, almost a big villa in its own grounds. And Mr. Lansdale lived in an ordinary terraced house. The contrast between the rectory and the nonconformist minister. He was very concerned with the relations between the different congregational churches in the area, and in 1890 gave a talk on the spiritual unity of independent churches to the Northern District Meeting of the Congregational Union, which led to the formation of a brand new Potteries Congregational Association. In 1896-7 he was the chairman of the Staffordshire Congregational Union and gave an address in the annual assembly in Leek, so that's what's now Trinity Church, on the Kingdom of God, which he said the kingdom is in the world but not of the world. The kingdom is not founded by political efforts. And he was thinking there of the fact that over in Newcastle, at that very time when he was speaking, there was a Labour church, a political church, in the old meeting house, the Unitarian chapel there. He said the kingdom is spiritual, not political. And he was the man who introduced Christian Endeavour to Staffordshire. So any of you who remember the Christian Endeavour meetings, who were involved in the Christian Endeavour meeting, I know some folk here were, you've got William Lansdale to thank for Christian Endeavour in Staffordshire. He was opposed to the South African War, the Boer War. He said it was due to the selfish aims of capitalists and companies. And he was also very interested in evangelism. Under his ministry, the church took the oversight of a mission chapel at Tomkin in the Moorlands. The chapel's still there, still uses a church today. It's a URC place now. And they would send out young men from the church to preach at Tomkin, to minister to the people of that small moorland community. He was also involved in church planting. The area down by Hanley Park was being developed at the end of the 19th century, and he was one of the men who made sure that they would start a new church at Park, which is called today Park Evangelical Church. He was one of the men who started that building. And when they finished establishing the building of the church at Park and put up the building there in 1902, they were meant to put up another building that never got built. I'm told that Park Evangelical Church today have pictures of that building that's supposed to be built. But when that building that's there now was built, they looked around, where can we plant a church now? And they decided to plant one at Woolstanton. And this time Lansdale went to pioneer a brand new work in Woolstanton, now Woolstanton United Reformed Church. He remained there for many years, then went off to do some more pioneer work, and eventually he retired to North Walsham in Norfolk, and I visited his grave this summer. It's still fairly well kept in the cemetery there. 1902 then, they needed a new pastor here, and the man approached was the minister of a church in Nuneaton, John Green Gascoigne, who was famed for his pleasant Sunday afternoon men's meetings. They sound very innocuous. They weren't necessarily. Some of them were hotbeds of socialism and labourism. I'm not sure Gascoigne's were, but he could get 500 working men together on a Sunday afternoon. The motto of the PSA movement, we have a book at the back from my collection, which was a PSA prize at Newcastle Congregational Church. And the motto was brief, bright and brotherly. And the idea was that they would get these men together for these meetings, which could become very, very political. But here again, he was a warm-hearted, Bible-loving evangelical, a man of one book, the Bible. In 1908, this popular preacher was called away to Manchester. His successor was a man called Mark Bairstow, who had been a Methodist. He'd been a United Methodist Free Churches minister, UMFC. And before he was ordained, he had a mission hall called Bairstow's Tabernacle, where his message was for Christ and against the Oxford movement. He founded an organisation based on the Salvation Army called the Red Ribbon Army. And he was eventually ordained by the denomination, who sent him off to Birmingham to get their church there going again. Well, while he was there, he was poached by the Congregationalists. There was a Congregational minister in Birmingham who had been a Methodist himself and thought, this young man should be a Congregationalist, not a Methodist. And so he was called then into the Congregational ministry. In 1908, he came here. He had, his obituary said, and we think his obituary was by his son, so it might be slightly biased. He had a wonderful dramatic power, being able to have his audience in laughter and tears within the space of 5 minutes. He was a devout Methodist with Puritan tendencies, but he did write a novel called The Village Blacksmith and The Squire's Daughter. Given it was published by a religious publisher, it was undoubtedly quite innocent, despite that title. He was called in 1912 to Barrow in Furness, and the church here was in quite a state financially by then. Membership was poor, they had to give up the chapel at Tomkin. In 1912, the church had a debt of £918. Doesn't sound a huge amount, but when you put that into today's money, it's about £40,000, which is quite substantial when your income is very low. He was then followed by a man called Tom Lancaster Moore, who was also pastor at Silverdale at the same time, because the church here couldn't afford to pay a full-time minister. And Moore was a lay pastor from Lincolnshire. Of course, he arrived in 1914, just before World War I broke out. 55 members of this church were lost in 1914. It's a shame that the war memorial disappeared at some point, because so many people here were affected. The PSA movement meeting, the men's meeting, ceased. Some of the best offices, it was reported, are now, the best officers and workers are now lads in khaki, it was said in 1915. How many of them failed to come home at the end of the war? How many of them are lying now in Flanders fields? Moore was an evangelical. His great message was this: Christ for me. In 1916 he left to go back to Lincolnshire. There was a succession of temporary pastors. The church was on life support, relying on bazaars and sales of work. There was one more congregational pastor, Mr. Hood, who put in so much effort. Doing the research of this book, he put so much in. He did so much, and yet the congregation went down and down and down. And eventually he left Ellesmere Port, and they tried to set up a joint pastor with Hanley Park. They had no money at the park either, and so they had to abandon that. And by 1929, the church was so overdrawn at the bank that the bank would advance them no more money. What was to happen? God sent Edward Jeffreys. Edward Jeffreys was the son of Stephen Jeffreys, the evangelist who would be one of the founders of the Assemblies of God. And his brother George founded the Elim Pentecostal Church. So Edward Jeffreys came from a good Pentecostal background. In fact, he was Pentecostal before his father was, because he went on a youth meeting in South Wales, and he spoke in tongues there and came back to his parents, to his father, and said how wonderful it was and how his father and uncle could speak in tongues. Interestingly enough, as an adult, he decided actually he wasn't speaking in tongues after all. So he converted his father and uncle to Pentecostalism and then left it himself. He began ministry as a singer with his father. He'd go out on these campaign meetings and Edward would sing. And Edward said one of the meetings, he and his father stayed with a farmer and he was given a hen as a present. But his father said, "You cannot keep the hen," and sent it straight back to the farm. His first pastorate was in Southend on Sea, and then he was called to Bristol in 1928. His father was doing a campaign for a friend of Edward's. The idea was that Stephen would do the campaign, Edward Jeffreys' friend would come along and he would pass the church. But the campaign was so successful that Edward Jeffreys' friend took one look at the crowds coming in and said, "I can't do that." And so Stephen called Edward and said, "Son, can you come to Bristol and take over? We need to keep these people together." And Edward Kay wasn't sure about it at first, but after the first night, so many people came forward to give their lives to Christ that he said, "This is the beginning. This is the great moment." And so he stayed in Bristol. Then in 1929 he decided we're going to go out from Bristol. And he began these great campaigns working northwards, going through Gloucestershire, Worcestershire, headed north until at the very end of 1930 he arrived in Hanley. And he hired the Victoria Hall. He'd come more or less alone. He was unknown. But he hired the Victoria Hall and he advertised, "The gospel will be preached." And the Victoria Hall was packed night after night. And the streets of Hanley thronged by people singing gospel songs and hymns. Singing the old gospel songs and the new ones. There were many who would sing what was called the Bethel rallying song. I don't know the tune, but these are the words. "We are marching in the ranks of Bethel. Keep the Bethel banner waving high. Tell the old, old story of the one who came to die, that we all might have salvation and the power to conquer every foe. Keep the Bethel banner waving wheresoever we may go." And they would walk the streets of Hanley after dark singing that. And yet, who was the man? What was he like? Well, he was, according to a man converted unto him, he was quiet, compassionate, and undemonstrative. Many years later, when he'd become an Anglican clergyman, evangelical Anglican, one of his converts visited him and said, "What happened?" And he said, "It was the work of God, and to him belongs the glory." Now, he built several chapels, several buildings, Bethel temples around, but he heard of two congregational churches that were in trouble. He came to them both, at Park and at Hope, and he said to the leadership, "If you will join my organization, my Bethel Society, then I will give you pastors, and I will bring my converts to you." And so the leadership here said, "Well, the choice is between closing and becoming Bethel Temple in Hanley." And so they chose to become the Bethel Temple in Hanley. and ceased to be Hope Congregational Church. Park again, they became the Bethel Temple there. Park remained in Bethel for a very, very few years before the minister there fell out with Edward Jeffreys. But the minister here, Pastor Anderson Brown, he'd been converted under Edward Jeffreys in Southend-on-Sea before Edward went to Bristol, and he came here, was a close friend, associate of Edward Jeffreys. He was here 1932-34, was followed by Pastor E.J. Vernon, who had been converted in the Bristol campaigns. He was a man who had a great love for Christ, and who stayed here in 1934 until his death in 1953. He had some troubles in the church. There was one in the 30s, about 34, 35, a group of men in the church were teaching what was called the British Israel theory, that the British are the Israelites, the 10 lost tribes. And they wanted Pastor Vernon to preach it, and he refused. And so they went and they founded a new British Israel church, which didn't last very long, in Hanley. The minister at Park, Mr. Hibbert, was a British Israel teacher, and he ended his days as a travelling lecturer for the British Israel World Federation. I'd like to have got some more information on him, but the British Israel World Federation would not return my calls. The Bethel Society was wound up in 1939. Edward Jeffreys decided to move on and shut down the headquarters, shut down the Bible school, and left the church independent once again. And it was the worst time to do it, really, because the war broke out. Many of the men went off. The church was forced to sell the old schoolroom to make ends meet. And Pastor Vernon, when he died in 1953, he died in the vestry of the old chapel. He was followed by Pastor A.W. Mead. We have two of Mr. Mead's children with us today. We are very happy to have them here. Pastor Mead came from Bristol and had been converted under Edward Jeffreys. In 1933 he was ordained over the Bethel Church in Congleton, the Bethel Temple in Congleton, and later took oversight of a fellowship at Tork as well, which is where he met his wife. He joined up in the war, and after he came back, he was an insurance agent until in 1953 he was called to be the pastor here. And even then he was an insurance agent, because he was called only part-time. He was a Bible teacher. He brought the church into the FIEC. He got the Sunday school going again. It closed because of the war. He got the Sunday school going again. He got Youth for Christ coming here. About 10 people were sent out into the mission field, or began their work, their journey onto the mission field during his ministry. In 1958 or thereabouts, the church name was changed from Bethel Temple to Bethel Evangelical Free Church. And the constitution was changed, so the church is now congregational in government again. He left us in 1963 to go to a work in Feltham in Middlesex, but he died while visiting family in this part of the world in 1973, and his funeral was held in the old chapel, which was most fitting because he had been such a blessing and such influence. He was followed by Desmond Evans, who was a Welshman, who was not with us very long. He was an evangelist, you know, a lay worker with Young Life, but he overworked himself tremendously. His business had failed shortly before he came here, and the mental stress of that and then the overwork led to him becoming increasingly irrational until he had to be hospitalised. He was doing things like cancelling speakers at the last minute and then cancelling himself. So he had to be hospitalised, and then he suddenly discharged himself went off to South Wales, from whence he sent a letter saying, I am resigning, do not attempt to question this. So the church said, well, very well, if you resign, and sadly, he left us then. He was followed by a gentleman who is with us today, Pastor Paul Brown, who was the longest serving pastor in the history of the church. He's here 1966 to 1994. Came from Southampton. He was one of two candidates I find looking at our files. The other one was a man called Neil Richards, who was of course at Wheelock Heath for some years. And Paul was accepted by the church because of his links with the FIEC. That was the particular thing that led to him being singled out as the next pastor, because of his links with the FIEC. Now, during his ministry, this building was put up. Put up because our neighbours, Tesco's, well, they had bought the old site next door and decided to dig a great underground car park. They dug all the way down and undermined the foundations. And so the old chapel here began to fall into the hole that Tesco's contractors had dug. But before then, there had been all sorts of questions as to whether the church should move. And some sites were recommended, including some existing chapels. Most bizarrely, given how there were people complaining about how much it cost to keep the old building here up, somebody suggested in 1964 that the old Tabernacle Congregational Church was closing, seated 1,000 people. And so they said, let's buy the tabernacle. Thankfully, that was overruled, because I think it would have been extremely difficult if we'd done that. Other places were suggested. The Welsh Congregational Church said, why don't you buy our building? But then they wanted an alternative site, and we could find one. The old Tabernacle Town Mission was suggested. Again, that fell through. Providence Chapel. Providence Place was suggested. Again, that fell through. But finally, of course, we rebuilt here after Tesco's started to demolish the old building by mistake. It's also during Paul Brown's time that we got a church car park. Before then, people parked along New Hall Street, but then a Jewish business bought the building opposite. And of course they opened on Sundays and not Saturdays. And so people were parked up there for the business. So we had to get a car park. But then a new building happened. We found a letter from, well, a statement from Paul in the vestry, in which he says that the 27th of April 1975 was one of the most miserable Sundays in his whole ministry. Nothing to do with the people, but to do with the fact that the building was starting to fall down. And there were so many cracks visible from the pulpit. By the 2nd of May, the old building was unsafe, and down it had to come. The Tesco's refused to accept liability to begin with, and so it all had to go to court. I'll read a few extracts from the judgment from Mr. Justice Walton in the High Court on Tuesday, the 17th of June 1975. Speaking of the excavation, he said, one only has to mention the fact that the excavation is going on so close to make it abundantly obvious to the layman as well to the experts in the construction industry. There will likely be problems of subsidence and support for the next door Evangelical Free Church. Tesco, he said, were under a duty of care. One cannot hire an independent contractor to carry out one's own duty of care to one's neighbour. He objected. The claim of the church is reasonable. As the Justice Walton went on, the first defendant, that's Tesco, seek to answer it by saying, oh, please, sir, it's not me, sir. It's that nasty second defendant's fault, and I have nothing to do with it. He said, if one employs an independent contractor to do something which, to its own nature, is likely to, not necessarily bound to, but likely to cause injury to other persons, one cannot get out of responsibility for it oneself. The first defendants, he said, had the impudence to point to the fact the plaintiffs are now meeting elsewhere as a point which somehow entitled the work to be carried on, because that meant there was no danger of life and limb. Having driven the plaintiffs and their congregation out of their premises, that is now turned into a virtue. I must say I find that a bit hard to stomach. But, he went on, very persuasive counsel said I should not grant the relief which the plaintiffs seek in their own best interest, because their own best interest requires that their work be pressed on with as quickly as is possible, so a suitable retaining wall is built. Of course, while it is being done, doubtless there will be certain further settlement and damage to the building, but that will minimise that damage, and at the end of the day, the defendants' works will have been consolidated, so the plaintiff's building can settle down, we will all know where we are. That seems to me to be the most ingenious way of describing riding roughshod over the plaintiff's rights completely. Which is why Tesco's paid for this building. The new chapel was designed by Mr. Andre Clues, who was a member here before he had moved to Leicester. We have some of the plans at the back. And so there's a question then, who would speak at the opening? And someone suggested Sir Frederick Catherwood would be an excellent speaker. And then someone else said, well, if we can't get him, we'll opt for Martin Lloyd-Jones. Lloyd-Jones, of course, was Catherwood's father-in-law. In the event neither were available, and it was Mr. W.H. Davis of the Baptist Tabernacle in Blackpool who spoke. And so we have continued the witness on this site. In the midst of all these various uncertainties and trials that have come, 1994, Paul Brown left us to go to Dunstable and has since retired. And since then we have had Mr. Phil Roberts and Mr. Hezron Muwowo as pastors, and now since 2009 I've been around and was ordained in 2010. We've gone on with preaching the gospel, with young people's work on this site, a Sunday school on a Sunday morning, young people's meetings on a Thursday evening, and so many people have heard the gospel here. And so we go on, we look to the future, and we can only think of a hymn that's been sung here on several occasions, written by Philip Doddridge, a hymn that is a prayer, O God of Bethel, by whose hand thy people still are fed, who through this weary pilgrimage hast all our fathers led. Our vows, our prayers we now present before thy throne of grace. God of our fathers, be the guard of their succeeding race. Which we can only say, Amen and Amen.